Hello, everyone, and welcome to the God of War podcast, episode 22. Today, I am joined by someone who I actually have admired for many years and who I was truly honored to see, I think, my name even mentioned on the page of the campaign itself. But yes, without further ado, the Lost Pages of Norse Myth campaign creator, Robert Sinclair. There you go.
Hello, hello.
Get these little claps
from
me.
Thanks for inviting me on. I appreciate it.
I absolutely had to. This is a very personal kind of triumph for me to speak with you directly and to be able to communicate this stuff to you live in this forum, because I can remember specifically the day. I don't know if you envision this sort of thing when you're putting the campaign together. I know you have your beautiful mission statement that you gave. It's like, here's our challenge and here's our solution. Like, beautifully laid out, a credit to you and your profession and your role. But I remember, please take this to heart and tell the rest of the team, having an absolute body-wide giddiness, like a body-wide sensation of like, is this actually happening? This level of dream come true, you know, synchronism of content or whatever the correct term is, where it is this thing that absolutely permanently enhances the material itself. And elevating the art, honestly, of ancillary support material to just like so far unmatched height, seriously. Ever since, you've basically ruined a lot of promotional campaigns for me. Every single time I'm like, where's the Lost Pages of Norse Myth equivalent for this and that and the other? So I absolutely have to personally hand it to you for that. And it is, I am such a huge, huge aficionado of your work with that, especially, mate, for sure. So thank you.
Well, that is quite a compliment. So thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, I mean, the project itself, the campaign itself is probably one of my favorite projects I've ever worked on. And, you know, all of it, of course, revolves around putting something together that is going to appeal to the fans. And, you know, I work at a digital advertising marketing agency. To put this campaign together, we had PlayStation as a client, and we're lucky enough to get this assignment to put together a promotional campaign for the new God of War game, new at the time. But our task is to make something that had a level of authenticity to it and genuineness to it that would resonate with fans. And so I'd be lying if I said, you know, every time we would release, you know, a chapter of the Lost Pages, I'd run straight over to Reddit
and, yes,
you know, see what, you know, see if people were liking it, if they saw it, if they got it. You know, gaming in particular, and gamers are such a passionate community and audience, and I'm in the audience. I mean, I've been a gamer my whole life, and I know how passionate that, you know, the communities can be. And the last thing you want to do is, you know, put something out into the world that that misses, that isn't received well, that doesn't feel authentic, that isn't answering, you know, questions that fans might have. So, You know, speaking for the rest of the team who worked really hard on this campaign, it was really gratifying to see how warmly it was received. And you know, it was kind of like this, you know, two-way interaction,
so
where we never really directly talked to one another, and, you know, until now in a situation like
this,
where the,
believe, you
know,
me,
the people doing the marketing, you know, can sort of observe it, observe the reaction to it. But we generally wouldn't, you know, interface directly with the fans. It's typically not our purview to do that.
Okay.
You know, the more direct interaction would typically be left for, say, you know, the studio's, you know, social media team or their community.
Interesting.
Team. Yeah, they're the ones that are gonna, you know, interface directly with fans. But we loved putting the content out into the world. And love seeing the fans' reaction to it.
Oh, well, that all changes today, especially with this podcast. Let it be known. I'm going to use this podcast as like this Gjallarhorn, like, let it be announced that let this be seriously the first of hopefully many opportunities to dive into this level of contributory material, which honestly, like God of War, its integrity, its the completeness of God of War is not. There's not even a discussion there. Like without the Lost Pages of Norse Myth, which is central to this, especially this reborn version of God of War. Like that's the central conceit is that he was in the myths, but then over the passage of time, which is actually congruent with the real world element of these books having passed through many hands and had a lot of the content actually burnt away because of probably religious differences, cultural differences. So you stepped up as this creator, as this artist, to do what the Santa Monica themselves are doing. Like you were on this unified creative wavelength of we have to honor that this is, even if it's an adaptation and it's a video game and it's a stylized adaptation, to honor that sense of us telling a very, very old and real world myth. Like you, in your realm, in your sphere of this supporting artistry, went there as well, and you were on that same wavelength, and just got goosebumps thinking about it. Seriously, like, and like it was absolutely felt in every component of it.
So, and thank you again for that. And you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly the concept, the approach that we wanted to take with this campaign. And just to give you, a little background or kind of, a little peek behind the scenes about how the Lost Pages kind of got started. Mm-hmm. As I said, I worked at a digital advertising agency, digital marketing agency in the Bay Area. We had PlayStation as a client, so we had done some work on some other titles Horizon Zero Dawn, The Last Guardian. And then we were lucky enough to be invited to pitch some ideas for the new God of War game. And so myself and a few other members of my team flew down to Santa Monica Studio. We're just up in the Bay Area, so it was pretty short trip there. Got there and as you can imagine, with the game still under very heavy development at the time, and such a big important IP for
lots of security, probably
security is just crazy. Like the landscape's a little different now because we're kind of in this pandemic era where we're essentially all communication is happening online, but this was before the pandemic, and if you wanted to see something about the game, you had to go there in person. There was no emailing stuff. There was no
none of this post COVID. Yeah,
no fax machines. It was like if you want to see something, you have to come into the office and then we can meet. So we flew down there and met with Corey Barlog, the game director, incredible guy. Some other members of the Santa Monica development team. And we also have, and I should say, I don't know if your listeners are very familiar with, the marketing of games, mm-hmm. but coming from the agency side, we're the ones who kind of produce, the promotional campaigns. We essentially have two clients when it comes to marketing a game. You've got the publisher of the game, your Sony or your Microsoft. That's the group that's typically paying the agency. They've got the marketing budget to make sure people know about the game. And then the second client you have is the studio, the developer.
Santa Monica.
Those are the artists and the technician that are so passionate about the projects that they're working on. So we kind of have these two groups, and both of which, of course, were involved in our initial briefings. We first heard from Corey, who's an amazing guy. I mean, anybody who's a fan of War, I'm sure.
The game is his baby. He's made it very clear it was his baby from start to finish. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure anybody who's a fan of the game has probably seen videos and interviews and behind the scenes material with him, and he's just such an incredible leader and storyteller, very smart guy. Crazy passionate about his work, and he gave us to kind of kick things off, he gave us a primer on just Norse mythology before really even getting into the game itself. Just kind of getting that introduction into Norse mythology. And, you know, most people, you know, kind of have a passing, you know, knowledge of Norse mythology, but it's also very, you know, especially in the last several years, it's been partly defined by people's experience with things like the Marvel movies, you know, with the Thor movies and you know, at least modern audiences kind of have that as the definition of what, you know, Norse myth is like, and what Thor and Odin and all these characters are like. And it's not that at all.
Okay.
You know, the Marvel movies are incredible. I'm a huge, huge fan of the MCU, but they do paint a very different picture of the world of Norse mythology. So Corey, you know, kind of shared with us the actual myths, the actual stories, even told us, you know, a couple of the real stories of Norse myth that really painted the characters and the gods as quite different than the characters you are familiar with in the movies. Mm-hmm. And also very different from Greek mythology, you know, I think the way he had described it was, you know, Greek mythology is almost more like a soap opera where the gods are, you know, just kind of living above everyone. And it's, you know, all of their stories are just very, you know, melodramatic and, but a soap opera was kind of an interesting way to put it. But Norse mythology, the gods are awful. They are
brutal.
They are mean. They're rude. They get in fights. They drink. They war with each other. They will often, you know, come down to Earth, you know, to Midgard and intermingle, you know, with humans and cause all kinds of trouble. And it was really eye-opening. And even characters like Thor in particular, there are some really dark stories about
Thor. Yeah.
But to touch on the point you made, and something I didn't know, you know, going into this was that all of these stories, you know, Corey relayed to us, he kind of explained that all of Norse myth is encapsulated in just one or two books. There's
the Prose Edda,
the Poetic Edda, the Codex Regis. And those were largely written by a single author.
Snorri
Sturluson. I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation of his name.
No, it's all good.
Imagine hearing that about any other culture where it's like it all kind of was, you know, came from almost a single source. And, you know, when you hear things like that and you know, you start getting a picture in your mind of this historian, this author, you know, in the 1500s, you know,
just writing away
this inkwell, you know, by candlelight, you know, writing down these stories, it's so inspiring. And what we ultimately kind of, you know, took away from that experience was the premise that you just outlined, which was, this is an old book. It's an old book. And, you know, you know, we've all heard stories in the news about things like the Dead Sea Scrolls and just you know, historical discoveries that have been made that cause you to question what you thought was, you know, kind of historical, you know, canon. For, you know, stories like the Bible. It's like, oh wait, there could be something more or different over all of those years. And
that's it.
You know, typically what'll happen for any kind of marketing or advertising agency, regardless of, you know, whether you're selling, you know, a jar of spaghetti sauce or or a car, you have to go away and come back with ideas. You have to have some kind of concept, sometimes called the big idea. And you need to come up with a few of them, and then, you know, you kind of pitch those to your client. Hopefully they get excited by one and buy it and let you produce it. So we went away from that meeting, you know, having gotten this really just rich input from Corey and his team. And I think it was honestly the first idea was, you know, what if, you know,
and that's you. That's you, yeah. Robert, saying, hey, hold on a minute, on the whiteboard, wait a second, the book idea. You know,
and it's funny, just as a little fun fact, normally the process is, you know, you go back, you know, and I'm on the creative, you know, team within an agency. You typically go back, you huddle with your team, you get together with your partners, your copywriters, your strategists, your creative directors, the account people, and you put together a brief and you spend days, sometimes weeks, you know, in a room, just, you know, whiteboarding out ideas and mapping things out and doing research and, you know, coming up with, you know, all these crazy ideas that eventually make their way into a presentation that you then make, you know, usually weeks later. What happened on this one was, on the way home from that meeting with Santa Monica, I was traveling with my copywriter partner, Nicole, and we were in the airport on the way home. And I remember it distinctly. We were eating burritos.
Nice.
At the airport, food mall. And yes, we started talking about this idea of the Prosetta and it being this actual ancient, you know, tome that's been around for hundreds of years. And what if over time pages went missing from the Prosetta and we are now going to fill them in? And what it does is it creates this opportunity to weave in the story of a new character, this, you know, a mysterious, you know, warrior from another land, who is now involved in Norse myth. We don't know where he came from or what he's going to do. And we don't know why his stories were, you know, kind of stricken from the record, as it were, but that gives us our in. Oh. And
that just happened over burritos. Seriously, you hadn't done that. Is just amazing. Happened over burritos. Okay. And so all teams out there.
Yeah, and sometimes it just happens. I mean, sometimes
it just happens. You
know, sometimes. if something just kind of feels right, it feels intuitively like a nice, authentic way to bring in or begin a story. Sometimes that's the strongest idea. Sometimes you do need to spend weeks or months, brainstorming and planning and strategizing and killing a bunch of ideas and developing those with your team. But yeah, this one just kind of came naturally to us, and it just we stuck with it, and yeah, we still of course had to go and, you know, think through tons of details, put together, you know, a presentation, you know, try to get our clients excited about the idea, and eventually that happened, and we produced the campaign.
Well, all I was going to say is, I guess I'll finish because from early, and I apologize for interrupting briefly, was, you know, now if any business professionals are wondering, like, just how to cut through weeks of whiteboarding and iteration, just go have some burritos, just relax, get into that Robert Sinclair headspace and see what comes, you know?
Burritos are just have some kind of magical fuel, I think.
Yeah, I'll have to make you a t-shirt that says burrito headspace. Extremely in joke, like only you and I from this podcast would recognize that.
It's a method I've revisited several times since then. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
The burrito method. It sounds like a Jim Jarmusch movie.
Happened to work out okay this time around.
Well, all jokes and japes aside, you really do know how to paint a sort of some mind's eye cinema for us there, because just as you were saying that, I was like, imagine just in the aftermath of such a secret meeting and just, you know, basically just absorbing that tome that they gave, you know, story Bibles. I know that Guillermo del Toro also does that. He has a huge one for each of his films that often none of those details ever even make it to screen or even in terms of a set or a prop, but they just inform, you know, the performances on a sort of emotional level. And as I mentioned before, like there was a feeling. It's funny that Pacific Rim came to mind because the two projects have an interesting connected DNA, which is that for Corey, there was this thing that he was going to do Mad Max, and he was going to do stuff with George Miller and all of that. And then things fell through studio-wise for him on that, and his kind of catharsis project was God of War. Same with Guillermo not getting Hobbit, he moved to New Zealand. That all fell from under his feet. Then Pacific Rim, it was his big catharsis moment. And I think part of what I think he poured into himself and these respective directors pouring into their work is bringing all of that back and forth of what they went through to creating this. And that's why I think, and I'll just say this, because it takes a like-minded creator like to pick up on what the other person's, that's why bands like Zeppelin and stuff, that's why there's an amazing back and forth, because they're on the same wavelength. I think Corey sensed the kindred spirit in you of someone who knew how to kind of cut through and see where he was at, because the intensity of the vision was propelled by like, I'm done with all this faffery with the Mad Max. I actually have a theory why the Valhalla thing in Mad Max is partly maybe associated to Corey. It's I don't know. I'll have to get both Miller, Master Miller on with Corey to confirm that. But you can tell that he had a lot to say, and it, all of that faffery sort of sharpened him into this focused, like, storytelling entity. And I honestly think if you hadn't been who you are in that moment and received it as you did and had that clarity as you did, burrito clarity, if we want to call it, that is the thing that really puts you on par for me with Corey in terms of artistry, in terms of clarity of execution, because they are siblings to me. Nothing, you might think supporting ancillary, like something is a baseline, but for me they exist on such a parallel, equal level. You know, the lost pages of Norse myth, so much so that, I mean, one of the first reveals was that reveal of the, you know, the sand sculpture, you know, it was just, so that it has yet to be topped in terms of that integration. Speaking of which, if we want to go page by page, with the diverse elements, because it was truly a multimedia. I mean, there was the Mimir app, there was the podcast and all of this. How did that multimedia component kind of enter into the notion of the lost pages?
Yeah, it's a great question. Part of it was driven by knowing, I think probably the biggest challenge of the campaign was how long it had to run. This was a campaign that was meant to fill in the gap between the time that very first, E3 trailer came out in 2016, knowing that the game isn't going to actually ship until sometime in, 2018. I think it was supposed to be 2017, got pushed to 2018. But we had a year to fill, with something, with some kind of content, some kind of story to sustain fans and to sustain their interest. Hopefully engage with them over a pretty long period of time. And you can't just, do the same thing, day after day or week after week, because people will get tired of it. So we, part of the strategy is to engage using different, technology, different media, showing up in different places, so that you can appeal to different interests that people have. So, We started off with a live performance with that sand artist kicking off E3 2017 on Jeff Keighley's Coliseum show. That was pretty cool.
But it was then very moving, Robert. It was so moving. I mean, I think you might be very close to it from that creative point of view, but people were bawling. People were really feeling the work that you put out there. So I have to act as a conduit of appreciation to you on behalf of all these people who have enjoyed it.
You're very kind. Thank you for sharing that. And that was, we wanted to, kind of kick things off with kind of an emotional element to it, something that was dramatic. And we were lucky enough. I'd remembered seeing, part of, coming up with, different media and different ways of engaging people is drawing on, you know, your own experience, things you've seen. Can you kind of remix or repurpose something you've seen in the past? I remember seeing that sand artist on, I think it was on America's Got Talent. I used to watch that.
How about that?
Show all the time. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is incredible. Yeah. And he's not the only sand artist in the world, but he's one of the best. Mm-hmm. And just remembering how evocative that really unique form of art is, where you're, you know, if you, people haven't seen, you know, the, how it works is essentially a light table, and the artists, you know, pour sand on it, set to music. And while the music is playing, they manipulate the sand to create pictures and change the sand formation, you know, in real time to create different pictures and tell a story. And I thought, wow, what an incredible, you know, way to tell a story. First of all, that's unique, hopefully memorable. And so we contacted that sand artist, got him on board, and you know, went through a whole process. I mean, I could spend hours talking about each and every chapter.
Oh, look, I'm kind of thinking we're going to have to get you back on for part 2 and 3. But please get into it as much as you can.
Yeah, it was such a cool, kind of emotionally driven. And really the important part of it was beginning to answer some of the questions that fans had. One of the, you know, when we first met with Santa Monica Studio, and to your point about, you know, kind of, you know, in very lucky circumstances, finding kind of kindred spirits on different teams. You know, when you first walk into a room, you're a stranger, you know, to the other folks in the room. They don't know you. You don't know them. And it's kind of up to you to begin to build trust. And that can only come over time. Yeah. So because of the nature of game development and how, you know, how precious the properties are, when you first begin those meetings, you know, the walls are up, you know, you're, you know, everyone's kind of guarded, you know, it's like, you know, and especially being cognizant and empathetic to the fact that the developers in particular are crazy busy. They are trying to make one of the best video games of all time, but it's a, you know, AAA tentpole title, super important to Sony. They are very busy, and to have to, you know, divert their time to meet with who's coming in today, a marketing oh, we have deadlines, you know, we're trying to get, you know, this stuff done and fix bugs and work on the story. So you have to, you know, be thankful and grateful for the time that they do carve out for you. But one of the funny things, and this is true of every game, and I imagine any other entertainment property, is you kind of begin with all the things you cannot do.
Right.
There
that's
are
good. Setting expectations.
There are obviously things that represent spoilers, and you know, so there was a laundry list of things that were just off the table. Totally understandable, of course. Totally. You kind of expected, but you know, characters like Balder, Faye, you know, the mother, those were like no, like those are, you will never ever say anything about those characters. Wow. And that's fine.
Okay.
Not totally. And that's cool, and it's great to know it on day one, so you don't even put any, you know, of your, you know, brain power behind anything like that. You know, make the guidepost kind of clear, and we'll stay within, you know, the boundaries that we're given, and come up with something that works in there. But what ended up happening, which is one of the things I'm really most grateful about, is over that time that we worked with both PlayStation and Santa Monica Studio was the amount of trust we were able to build up with both teams. And that only happens over time. And it only happens by, you know, little victories that just happen, you know, one after the other. That starts
not just over time, but I think it is you, team. And typical, I think some of the best artists, they have this very endearing blind spot towards their own greatness on a creativity level, and then on a sort of, which is also very important for me in artistry, is rapport building. I think the whole thing of the aloof artist is just a crutch, really. I think you can be a phenomenal artist and also a really great interfacer and like liaising and that back and forth. And I think, as you mentioned, you had this really readily out of a holster this language of like walls being built and rapport and like taking time. I think your handling of that, you know, as you said, there's tensions are high, especially with such a I think in some senses pretty unprecedented complete perceptual rebranding. So they would have had the stress of a new game, the stress of doing a unprecedented level of rebranding of a very beloved property. So they would have been very right up there in the 11s of stress. And it's a credit to you that you helped say, look, as much attention as we can get, as much input, very happy to work with you, very fluid. And I think honestly, the campaign speaks for itself in terms of how much respect was shown and how much common ground was reached. And again, a credit to you, mate, for sure.
I appreciate that. And it was just, it was such a cool feeling to kind of go from, you know, those initial meetings and build, you know, generating and building up the excitement to towards the end when we were developing the podcast and being able to write, you know, stories that were, you know, essentially part of the canon, you know, of the game.
Yeah.
I think there were something like eight or nine episodes of the podcast. And each one started off with, you know, a 10 or so minute long just myth, just story.
Mm-hmm.
And my team has, you know, some incredible writers on it. And I was lucky enough to also be able to write a few of those episodes too. It was probably my favorite part of the campaign was writing those stories and knowing that we were, you know, kind of co-creating these kind of background stories. So going from, you know, meeting one where it's kind of like, here's some things that you guys are not going to be allowed to do, to months later, actually writing some stories that were kind of considered, I wouldn't go so far as to call them official, but they weren't.
Robert.
They weren't heavily edited at all. They weren't killed. So it was so fun, you know, to
you don't understand. I'm my composure is wavering because of hearing that you were behind the writing. I know the Wisers, you know, what a great, you know, the Myths and Legends podcast, great partner. I think you got with them with the delivery of them, but specifically the writing of the Lost Pages, knowing that you were involved. I mean, you, Robert Sinclair, wrote, I would say, what would you say the percentage of those episodes, and especially the lore part? Obviously that's, those 10 minutes in the start of each episode, is that mostly you?
No. So, and one thing to again, make very clear is, you know, campaign like this, just like the game itself,
it's collaborative.
Like this, it is a team effort, 1,000%.
Being collaborative. Okay. Okay.
Something like this would not exist, you know, from one person at all. There is a huge team behind the Lost Pages campaign. And my immediate team, it was actually three copywriters. There was my boss, Brad, who has a copywriting background, and I had two copywriting partners, Kyle and Nicole. And for the writing of the podcast, it ended up being, again, I think like nine episodes. We divvied them up between myself, Brad, and Kyle, and we each wrote a few episodes. It was just kind of a nice way to, you know, not just divide up the labor a little bit, because, you know, we all have deadlines we're working towards, but it also gave everyone a chance to use their own unique voice and storytelling skill to just have fun and write something. So, and that I think was one of the first times that your name kind of caught my eye, because I had written the Forging of Leviathan story. Which is so fun, you know, with
redolent of Tolkien's mean, I think I said, like,
yeah, really, and I was like, oh, that. I saw that quote and I was like, I like this guy.
Well, big hugs to you for that, man. Seriously. And that's all you. It was a purely energetically alchemical thing where I was like, me meeting this level of artistry with this level of respect to like the myths that inspired Tolkien, that evoke that in the writing, in the gravitas of the writing, which, by the way, those episodes are evergreen. They are evergreen. I still visit them. And especially now leading into Ragnarok, where Odin does feature, you know, Groa and Odin, they open those episodes. And I'm now picturing, because we've seen them in silhouette, and I know you can't comment with God of War Ragnarok, of course. But yeah, Richard Schiff, you know, and now when I'm listening to them, I'm back populating those figures with what some of what we're seeing, it is yeah, like I said, it stands that this is, I've said it three times now, I guess maybe many more times, but it stands as the most hype stoking and immersive, genuinely forms of coexisting and supporting symbiotic kind of artistry that I've ever seen in certainly in this medium. And to conclude, not just this big word salad for you. I make a lot of word salads. Is that I was in the, especially during this time, I was wondering about interactive arts path forward in terms of maturation, because I think this mantle that games have is it's sitting there a lot of the time. People, I would say 80% of the time, they don't step into the potential, the empathy deepening and humanity engaging potential of games, which is that we all experience life interactively. We're making our choices constantly, and that's, games are unique in all art forms in that they do that too. And to see you like aggressively leverage that with this multimedia component, like bleeding into real life, like people listening to these myths on their commutes, playing with the app, later we'll talk about the Mimir app, like that level of embodying the thing that I love interactive art for in the first place, like in what you do and who you are, it's like, yeah, it just generated so much back-to-back levels of hype. Oh my God, a new episode of The Lost Pages. Like it was and continues to be like a triumph, man, for sure. So
well, had to mention that too. It's interesting you use the term maturation, and that's another component, a really important component that we had picked up on and learned from Corey and his team, even at that very first meeting when he was kind of, you know, prepping us and you know, introducing us to the game. As you said earlier, you know, a big challenge this title had was how different it was from, right, the original trilogy that was, you know, insanely great on its own, but it was a very different game. It was more arcadey, you know, kind of that button mashing, you know, wildly chaotic, kind of game style. And, you know, of course, when that trailer came out in 2016, it was surprising to see the change in pace, change in tone. And of course, you know, the introduction of, you know, big things like the fact that Kratos has a son now, and, you know, fans had questions like, is this the game series that I loved? Is this something new? Is this going to, you know, I've got a son now. Is this going to be like an escort quest game, or I've got a,
there was concern
everywhere. How did Kratos get from, you know, from Athens to Midgard? Like, what happened? And so, and just getting back briefly even to that sand artist performance, you know, one of the things that we were able to do, you know, just despite, you know, kind of the guidelines that we had, was we were able to begin to answer some of those questions that fans had, which is, how did Kratos get there? Where did the axe come from? Where did the sun come from? And if you watch the sand artist performance, of course, you're not going to get tons of detail in that style of performance, but you see that Kratos arrived on a boat to Midgard. You see that he met a woman who was the original owner and wielder of the Leviathan axe, and he took ownership of that axe. You see that they had a baby who grew up to Atreus. And what was even shocking to us as a creative team working on that, we even revealed that the mother died at the end of, at the end of the sand performance. We're like, isn't that kind of a big, big spoiler to share on chapter one of The Lost Pages? But then you come to find out, not so much of a spoiler, because the game literally opens moments after that, that funeral pyre. That's the opening of the game. So it's not, you know, if it's a spoiler, it only spoils the first 5 seconds of the game. But what was really interesting, just getting back to that theme of maturation, is something Corey actually shared with us. And you were talking about, you know, the artists and how passionate they are. And to me, a lot of that comes into whatever project you're given, an assignment you're given, whether you're a game developer or you're working at an ad agency, is, you know, what can you put of yourself into your project to help make it feel more authentic and yeah. let that passion kind of come through.
And what was that for you?
That Corey had shared with us was one of the reasons why the tone of the game is so different and quote unquote more mature is because guess what? He's more mature. Corey was mm-hmm. more mature. The developers who had been at Santa Monica Studio for many years are also more mature. And the fans who grew up playing the original God of War trilogy, guess what? They've grown up too. And they have different expectations now. And maybe it's not that big of a surprise to know that Corey has a son.
There you go.
And those feelings of fatherhood and responsibility, you know, those make their way into the game, and it feels so authentic because it's coming from a place of authenticity, and it feels so true, and the fans pick up on that, and they can feel those emotions when they play the game.
But you helped them, and I think it's important to give credit where it's due with this. I think maybe not that it's like a distant star in terms of being related on a subject matter level, but with upcoming things like events or changes, campaign managers, literally, like they can help with, you know, trickling out that information so that when things get to that point, that it's not as much of a shock or a sea change. And look, I had picked up a lot with this medium with a certain direction change, especially going into newer gen of this, you know, like the Order 1886, for example, like chromatic aberration, filmic quality, like with the increase in graphical fidelity came this increase in the ability to portray mature content like Last of Us Part 2, etc. But I would still say that around when you were being brought on, it was still not quite settled in. And honestly, this endeavor needed a guiding hand, and it needed that spaced out kind of assistance, you know, where you actually very much, I don't know how it would be to figure out the exact numbers, but I think I saw a breakdown at one point. But in terms of adoption rates, adoption of the new idea, adoption of this new direction for God of War, I would absolutely say that your work with your team contributed significantly to this being as well received as it was. Obviously, the art in its complete form speaks for itself as a product, you know, and as a story itself. But on a cultural level and on a human level, you helping kind of pave that way, lay that path for God of War to be as embraced as it was, absolutely merits a lot of credit and celebration for sure. So yeah, like it all translated. Yeah. I'm just here to say it all worked.
For the compliments again.
It's just the truth, man.
Yeah, and you know, every, you know, especially, you know, the bigger titles coming from the big publishers, I mean, it's such a vast landscape now in terms of engaging with fans. That every big game that comes out now, you know, you're not, you know, the world of marketing these games has changed so much. You know, in the old days, you know, you would put all of your marketing budget into developing a big CGI trailer, you know, put it on TV, tell fans to pre-order it and just wait. And, you know, hopefully it'll get good reviews and you're done. But now every big game has a big community around it. And the community goes online and they talk to each other. And if you're not part of that conversation, you're not able to participate in the narrative, and who knows
what's going to happen.
You know, I could come up with a list of games as long as my arm about, you know, big titles that have not done a good job in engaging with their communities and kind of leaving them hanging. And it's kind of too bad, because the games itself are sometimes really good, but you know, mm-hmm. it's the community, it's a living, breathing entity, and you kind of mm-hmm. got to feed the fans, you know, some great stories and content, especially in a situation where you've got that year to fill up. And that's, of course, not always the case. But the days of that kind of one-way communication of broadcasting out your content and, you know, kind of calling it a day, it's over. Like you have to come up with all these different ways of engaging with fans.
Well, now I have to ask, because of the success of the campaign, and on, I like the notion, the truth really of artistic success coming as a consequence of something that's happening on a human level, of like lessons learned and like who the person's become over time. And Denis Villeneuve, director of Dune, he has a refrain, which is, my art is my commerce, you know, which is that you'd make the art great. You really invest in it, and then the rest will do itself. And that's, again, that Corey direction setting that he had, that you picked up on, that your creative instincts picked up on, that sense of like where evolving a brand, which is another thing which I have to highlight as a sidebar to this main point, which is God of War has permanently shifted in terms of its perception. Like you type God of War Google, you'll just see blue, no more red. It's just the blue of this new era, of the Norse era. And I dare say, like, that's, I mean, I've never experienced such a change, but so two-parter, I guess. One is, if you wanted to comment a bit on that, the scale of that, and whether maybe you guys just kept your head down, didn't think about how big that was, number one. Number two, I want to maybe get a sense of the origins of what led you early on as an artist, formative stuff, where it's like, I think integrity is important, I think engagement's important. So taking us a bit back into the Robert Sinclair history. So you can take either of those first. Yeah. Whichever you like.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like the scope and scale, obviously we, you know going in, this is God of War, it's a huge tentpole franchise. And we were confident in the concept of having, you know, the kind of the sometimes called the red thread, you know, the common theme of the lost pages that we can now weave through all of the chapters. And, you know, you do a certain amount of planning up front. You know, I've got dozens and dozens of presentation decks that, you know, you develop over time to kind of carefully plan out things. One of the things that may or may not be interesting to your listeners is just kind of a little bit of the process of marketing any game has always been pretty formulaic, right? It's like, you know, pick any game out of a hat, and what's going to happen? There's always going to be that first trailer that typically has a lot of effort put into it, right? And it premieres at E3 or wherever. That creates the initial wave of buzz. And now the developers can go back to work. But what happens after that is you know with a certain level of confidence that between that point and the time the game comes out, there's going to be a fairly regular schedule of material that's made available to the fans. You might, and this is a generalization, but you might start off with, say, you know, releasing some concept art. Because maybe the screenshots and videos are still being polished, and those aren't quite ready for public consumption. So you have screen, you know, you have concept art available to you. Then so at some point after that, you're going to drop a package of screenshots, because now those have been tightened up and they're looking good. Let's release those as content and drum up some excitement again for the game. Then you might get to a point where you start seeing some video. Maybe it's behind the scenes, you know, development. Maybe it's a short video, perhaps even, you know, if it's on a shorter time frame, maybe there is a second trailer ready by then. But what these things are doing is this kind of trickle of media is also usually timed. And again, this is just a generalization. But the marketing folks, on especially on the publishing side, have already planned and mapped out these beats in the timeline, there are aspects of any game that they want to emphasize. So it might be the location of the game. It might be the new character of the game. It might be the arch villain of the game, or it might be the weapons in the game, or the level design in the game, the multiplayer component in a game. And so they kind of have those, you know, mapped out ahead of time. And we knew that. And that was true for God of War. So part of our process was, you know, kind of dealing with that scope and scale of the campaign, was also mapping those beats. And we did have ones like, you know, introducing the characters, talking about, you know, some of the environments like Midgard, introducing the weapons, you know, the Brock and Sindri, you know, dynamic with the Leviathan axe and the bow and the shield. There, you know, of course, there's no, you know, multiplayer component, but you know, there were beats that we wanted to kind of map some of our content to, and we literally created a map, a timeline that was meant to kind of address those key moments in the game. So anyway, so yeah, we would use, you know, when you have something as scope as big as that, you kind of have to break it down into bites.
Well, see, that would have been comforting. I think maybe that would have been, again, I think I alluded to it earlier, it's like, all right, not going to think about the crazy big picture, like, you know, the what's at stake or whatever. Like, obviously we'll let that inform, you know, our dedication and our work ethic and all of that, commitment and all that, but we'll mostly just kind of stick to these beats. And it's like, hey, you know, don't worry, like, we've got this path laid out. And I suppose, as you said, I mean, isn't that something in personal and professional development, is like, if you have an issue, maybe you can break it up into little pieces, makes it easier as you go along.
And I know you don't want to hear it, but that's where the team comes. That's where
I love it. I want to hear it. I love that. Yeah, and by the way,
you know, especially coming from an agency, that's where you've got these critical members of the team that are on the account services team that are fielding, you know, questions from the client all the time. So we had an amazing account team, Julia, Davina, David, on the team. You've got project managers that are kind of handling, you know, the day-to-day work. And then you've got producers who are handling kind of the high level, you know, work that was, you know, say done on some of, like, the, you know, the CGI videos that we did that just have a lot of moving parts. And you're working with another partner that are experts in doing that. Producers have to, like, cost all that out and come up with all these schedules and timelines and make sure things are being delivered when they're supposed to be delivered. So yeah, it is absolutely, you know, the coordination of, you know, dozens of people to get all these things on time.
Think, yeah, we said this in our emails. It's like, because initially our listeners and viewers, the idea of bringing some of the other folks on the campaign in was initially fielded. It just was a matter of scheduling, short notice, but it's not over yet, baby. Like, that's the idea, is to really like crack open the amount of work that was done. And that's one thing later I'll see if you're able to gauge, because sometimes things, you know, are very fluid with and maybe not metered so much, like how much time, how many months. I guess I can maybe see if you might have a sort of instinctive, like, so that if it occurs to you, like, how much time did me and my time spend on it overall? Would you say over a year, maybe two-ish years, or?
Yeah, I think probably a couple of years.
Yeah,
I could literally go back through my files and find, you know, dated presentations of, like, you know,
that's the dream to me.
All the way through to the end, when, you know, when we're doing wrap up reports and, you know, submitting, you know, the work to, like, award shows and stuff.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of an interesting time capsule to kind of look back and go, like, oh my God, we've been working on this for a long time. It's nowhere near the amount of time the developer actually spends on the game. Mm-hmm. I think they've probably been working on the game for three, four, 5 years before we ever were, you know, involved at all. So they kind of lived their life by this game for years before.
I mean, you each had your own tasks, you know, and I think that understanding you each had, and that respect, I think that collegiateness between, and I know you mentioned, like, the agency, I'll just call it the agency if you don't want to name, like, where you were, do you want to name them, or it's just like, you, yeah, it's cool. Just, we'll just call them the company you were with.
Yeah. The agency, yeah, the works.
The agency for sure. Yeah. With Santa Monica Studio, like, really understanding your roles, like that meeting of the minds and that kind of aligning with that one vision. You have really started something by telling me that you have that all somewhere with, like, the steps towards, you know, from the very first, which I think it was obviously the sand performance. And then now you actually said the cinematic trailer. So if for myself and the listeners, viewers, the total number of I guess you could say products that you guys put together, to my mind, we have the Lost Pages podcast, where there's a bit of a bleed over with the sand presentation because it counts as page zero or page one. Yep. So those two. Then you had the Call of the Wilds Facebook integrated game, I think. That's what, was that you guys as well?
Yep. Yeah, I can actually take you through.
Can you let's go? Let's from the man himself. Yeah, go ahead.
I'll tell you the order of them. We started off with the Sam performance, the official title of it, which I always thought was pretty cool. The title of it Born was of a Ash. Saga Born of Ash, yeah. And you know, anybody who's familiar with God of War knows the significance of Ash. Mm-hmm. In Kratos's history, you know, that's why he was, you know, referred to as the ghost of Sparta, right? Because he had this ashen white skin, and the ashes were from his family.
Spoilers are all good. And did you call it? Is that your nomenclature? And feel free, I can tell you're I love that emphasis on team, but feel free to be like, and so came up with that exact title, and so came up with that exact idea. Born of Ash is a
I honestly can't remember. I would be happy to claim more credit for it, but I honestly don't remember who came up with that name, but it seemed to fit really well. And it's got a little bit of that morbid quality to it if you know the story, but it also just kind of sounds interesting and cool. But that was the first chapter. That was chapter one. It was a Saga Born of Ash. So we went from the live Sam performance over into social media. And again, just one of the cool things and one of the ways we decided to kind of break this down into kind of digestible pieces, not just for ourselves, but for fans too. And part of our job and our responsibility to help ease people into, you know, the world of Norse mythology is, well, how do you do that? Like, that's a big jump to take. So, you know, like any other journey, you got to start with the first step. And, you know, just thinking about, you know, the hugeness of Norse mythology. And what was also interesting to me, and again, I'm sort of speculating here, but just at least in my experience, you know, kind of growing up, in the States, in California, our school system doesn't seem to teach Norse myth as much as it does Greek myth. And I don't know why that is. And it may not be true of everywhere, but I grew up watching movies like Clash of the Titans and Jason and the Argonauts. And you're kind of steeped in Greek mythology, but not as much Norse mythology for some reason. People just don't know as much about Odin and Thor as they do, you know, Zeus and Perseus. I don't know why. Everybody's experience is a little bit different in that regard. But for all the fans that had questions about, like, why is it Norse mythology now? Well, I don't know as much about that. I've played at least three games of God of War, if you don't count the mobile games, about Greek. I know all those gods. I've killed them all. I know them all. So one of the things we decided to do was ease people into kind of the culture of Norse mythology with one of the first things you might want to learn more about, which is language.
Language, the runes. I love those.
What a great and logical, I think, first step to introducing people to Norse myth. And one of the things I had done after that initial meeting with Santa Monica is, of course, I wanted to read the Prose Edda and the Poetic Edda. These are ancient books, but guess what? You can download them on your Kindle for $2. why not? Why not, you know, spend a little time reading these really great stories? And, you know, you learn not just the story, the actual Norse myth stories, but you learn more about the authors, you know, Snorri Sturluson, but also the style of writing that was used back then by the scholars. So just as an example, you know, one of the things that we learned was that the historians and the authors of the time who wrote mythology used a writing technique called kennings. And kennings are—it's essentially a term that means you're writing using a metaphor. So one like very very basic example would be saying, "Odin's son picked up the hammer." Odin's son is a kenning technically because it's not. You know, and I'm sure the fans know that Odin's son means Thor. He is the son of Odin. But what the historians and the scholars liked to do back then was they liked to challenge their readers.
Yeah.
They wanted to challenge their intellect a little bit, see if they could keep up with what they're writing about. So they developed these kennings, and some of them were really, really kind of complex, but it's a fun, it's like baking little puzzles into your story.
Oh, great.
Just to kind of challenge your readers as you go. So I thought that was really cool. So when it came to, you know, having some of these initial engagements with the fans, and this is an example of kind of timing something like that with knowing that we had some assets available to share with the community, in this case, concept art, because it was very early on. The next chapter was called The Riddle of Runes. And so we would go on Facebook and we would post runic, you know, the Elder Futhark, you know, runes, some phrase in Elder Futhark on Facebook, and challenge the community to translate it.
Yes. And if they did, very much love them.
I say if as if it weren't going to happen, you know, within seconds of us posting it. But, you know, once the translation had been done, it actually was a phrase readable in English. And one of them, one of the phrases was Hodor's wicked bite.
Hodor, yes.
Which you could, you know, Google at this point, you find out is the Norse god of winter. And so Hodor's wicked bite was a kenning that related to winter. Hodor's wicked bite was the cold ice and snow. And so once that little riddle had been solved, guess what? We had a bunch of winter themed concept art for locations in Midgard that we could then post to the community as a thank you and a reward for the community for engaging with us. So, you know, you could just post
that's stuff. Beautiful.
You could just upload, you know, concept art to Twitter. There's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, why miss an opportunity to have some fun and to engage your community? So anyway, I'll blaze through.
No, we're going to park this bus along the way, because for each of them, I want to say a tiny little blurb. I know, hopefully you don't just think, oh, he's just, every time he opens his mouth, he's just going to say, but it merits mentioning. I'll throw questions. We'll riff obviously back and forth, but for that component in particular, of honoring the artists, which, by the way, art is storytelling. All those concept artists, they work really hard on that. And as they're creating the art, they're thinking about the story behind it, like the Vance Kovacs, the Stephen Oakleys, the Ralph Grassettis, like everyone who produced that art had a sense of like mystique when they were making it. So the fact that you created a tiny bit of like very beneficial delayed gratification with that is also in alignment with their ethos as they were making it, and absolutely enhance the experience of the reveal, like creating a little barrier. It's one of those things that if we're not careful, the younger people will run away from them, this idea of this is the beauty of not getting it straight away, you know, not scrolling past so quick, like having to engage. I love that so much.
That's kind of one of the funny realities of creating, you know, content for in this, you know, kind of all digital, all social, you know, day and age, is that the half-life that your content has in the world. And there's a real kind of dread that you have that you're going to spend all of this time and money and passion developing this content, and somebody's just going to scroll past
and
they're just scrolling through, and you're lucky if somebody sees it for 2 seconds.
Anti-scrolling network. We literally fix these particular elements like your work, and it's on a podcast for at least an hour and a half where we just get to immerse into that. So this is an exercise in honoring your work.
That reality is honestly back in the planning process. We knew this is not a surprise that's just how the world works now, but we didn't want to lose that stuff, especially for something that was going to be happening for a year. People are going to miss stuff. Even if they're fans, you're going to be away from your computer. You miss that post on Reddit, or you're not on Facebook for a couple of days. And so knowing that was a reality and wanting to preserve, you know, as much of this story as we could, that's what really drove our recommendation to have the website. for all of this content. So even now to this day, I guess to prove the point, that you can still go to the PlayStation website, to the original God of War games product page, scroll down, and there's still a module for the Lost Pages.
Lost Pages.
Where you can open up the book, see the table of contents, and navigate to any of these pages, including the podcast. So all of that time that we spent developing this content, it has not disappeared from the world.
It's great.
You know, a lot of people find on Google, but there is still that literally kind of a time capsule now where you can see the rest of the content. And I'll just kind of quickly go through familiar of that table of contents. So we had did the Sand Art performance, the Song of Mordvath, the Riddle of Runes was the fan engagement with kind of the language. We then did a series of videos to introduce some of the enemies of the game. That was another beat that we wanted to hit for the marketing, was introducing this incredible, beastiary of new enemies. So we released three videos called The Creatures Arise, which featured, again, concept art, really beautiful, amazing concept art of the Draugr, of the Witch, and of the Trolls, three of the the pillars of, enemy combatants in the game, and worked to produce some really beautiful videos for that chapter. And then the next chapter, we again produced more traditional kind of storytelling video, where we introduce one of the triptychs in the game, which are, the three panel wooden kind of fixtures that you encounter in the game that, give you a little bit of break in storytelling. But fans haven't played the game yet. They don't know what those are.
Yeah.
So we did an animated one called the Dead Stonemason. Where we used some really beautiful CGI rendering and worked with, again, another thing to also keep in mind and just to kind of be aware of for a campaign like this, where you've got an ad agency, a marketing agency, coming up with these concepts and ideas. No agency in the world, big or small, employs enough people that you have an expert in every possible form of media to produce stuff.
So you had to outsource. Yeah.
So you partner up with other, really talented, hopefully the best in class vendors to help you do things like incredible, CGI videos, the augmented reality application, the messenger chat bot. Like, you don't just have those people sitting, in a corner in your agency.
No.
Fine partner. So we were lucky enough to work with some agencies, like some vendors like the Mill and Mood Visuals. To create some of these really beautiful videos for us. Another kind of fun example of technology, and we tried to kind of pepper in both what I would call traditional storytelling, which maybe are like those videos where it's really cool, authentic storytelling, like gather around the campfire kind of stories that are, they're kind of broadcast out and hopefully they're well received by the audience. But then you maybe would follow that up with something a little more interactive and engaging. I think our next beat in the calendar was to talk about some of the weapons in the game that are, of course, so integral to the God of War experience. So we did, I can't necessarily say it was the first ever of its kind, but certainly unique at the time, was we partnered with Sketchfab, who were known for 3D models. And they were, at the time, the only third party who had gotten approval from Facebook to natively integrate their technology into the Facebook feed. So we were able to post interactive 3D models right in the Facebook feed. So as you're scrolling through, looking at photos and videos, all of a sudden, you could drag your finger around and spin the Leviathan axe around interactively.
Yeah, incredible.
And we did that with the Leviathan axe, the Guardian shield, and Atreus's talon bow as one of the chapters of the Lost Pages. We followed that then up with the Facebook Messenger game, The Call from the Wild, which is one of the bigger I could talk for a long time just about that.
Oh, yeah, the branching paths. How is that?
Interactive text adventure. And shout mm-hmm. out to my buddy Kyle, a copywriting partner, who had the Herculean task of actually mapping out all everything. Of the storyline paths of that game. And then also working, you mentioned his name a few minutes ago, Vance Kovacs, a concept yeah. artist from Santa Monica Studio, who created some original concept art for the Call from the Wilds Messenger game, which is still live, it's still active. You can actually still go
yeah.
And play. I've been a gamer my whole life, and not to date myself, but talking about kind of remixing, or reinterpreting older experiences that you had. I've been text-based. Around games since the days of Zork.
King's Quest. That's right. Go to left. Open door.
Yeah. The old typing games that are very retro, but they were formative. For me as a gamer and a creative person. And so what a cool callback to be able to take that sort of technology and bring it into the modern day with chatbot technology. Essentially, we worked with a great group called Run Dexter. Mm-hmm. who did all kind of the behind the scenes programming of the logic of that game and how it worked. But again, just, especially with social media, there is an expectation, a reality that, if you're asking for somebody's time, you have to give them something. You owe your viewers something for their time. Yeah. And in that case, the gift that, or the reward that we gave them was original art that had never been
beautiful Vance Kovacs art.
Yeah, I love that. That's the stuff that still gets reposted to Reddit still
all the time.
I love when I see that. Yeah. We actually had it's sort of an unofficial chapter of the Lost Pages, but at some point during that year, there was PSX, the PlayStation Experience, mm-hmm. the live show. It's kind of like the PlayStation's version of E3, but just for their own first party titles, and they had that year they had a big God of War booth there because the development of the game was full steam ahead at that point, and it was cool because they had this big booth, and it was set up partly like a little museum
where that's the dream. I loved it much.
They had under glass all of these cool artifacts. They had Atreus's toys, like the real
model. Yeah, the runes. I loved
it. They had both of their costumes as if they were like Hollywood props, like behind glass. And what was really cool was they essentially took the story of A Call from the Wilds, and they made sort of a dark hallway in the back half of the booth, where you could hear Mimir, the voice actor, narrating the story of A Call from the Wild, and we took Vance's art and blew it up on big projectors. So as you're walking through the dark maze hallway in the back, you're seeing this beautiful artwork, like larger than life. We ended up getting these huge canvas prints done of some of his work, and we actually had one in the agency's lobby in our headquarters. We had this giant 6-foot by 6-foot canvas print of one of his pieces. That was so cool.
We can't skip past the museum thing because you went into it, but once again, when I saw that walkthrough, and it's actually hidden. You can't find, if you try to YouTube it, it's like, oh, interactive experience, God of War at 20. It's buried inside another video. So I'll have to extract it at some point. I think I did for the podcast Instagram feed, but as a kid, I remember like museums have a bit of a kind of a magic quality, especially with the work that they do with lighting and shadows and stuff. Yep. And to just see all of these props like from another world. I even said this in some of the early God of War podcast intros. I said it feels as though the team, and this includes you, obviously, because of that extended everyone who brought this to life in its various incarnations. It's like you all went to, the Norse realms and like created from that experience of having immediately, like that's what people said of Tolkien, is like he went there and he reported back, and like, so I was drawing an equivalency between your work again and Norse myth and Tolkien and all that. And when I saw that, I was like, this is too much, Robert, like this is going beyond like not only this interactive this podcast, the Call from the Wilds, but that particular experience was absolute, like the definition of dream come true. To see Atreus's book, you know, with his mother's book there, like the actual prop of it, like lending that kind of that credence to you know, that one there.
There was actually, if I remember this right, there was actually an accidental spoiler in one of the displays that I don't think that was supposed to be there. In one of the display cases, they had the Bifrost pendant,
Baldur,
and it said Baldur on it, and Baldur had not been revealed at that point. So at that point, I could sight read the Elder Futhark runes.
Oh yeah.
Because I was just kind of steeped in it at that point. And I was like, that says
how'd you go? Were you stressed?
People aren't supposed to know about that. We didn't have as much to do with the museum component of it as an agency. That was run by a separate group. Although, you know, shows like that tend to get, you know, pretty chaotic. There's lots of things going on everywhere. And, you know, my writing partner, Kyle and Brad, my boss were there at the show, and we ended up, and we were just experiencing it like fans. You know, we didn't have anything to do with the museum part of it, since that was, you know, run by a different group, but we knew the story so well that we ended up just becoming sort of ad hoc tour guides as fans were kind of going, because we were just hanging out there anyway, because it was fun. And we ended up taking groups through the tour and pointing out some of the artifacts and describing them. And there was really no prompting to do that, but we just kind of helped fill in some of the gaps there. But
that's awesome. I remember seeing
that spoiler with Baldur, and I was like, I don't think that's supposed to be there. But anyway, and then there were just a couple final check, because at this point we're getting pretty close to the release of the game. And as much as we had, you know, planned out as carefully as we could, all of the chapters and the story and the beats we wanted to hit, some things change. There were definitely parts of the Lost Pages that were planned and never made it. But there were also new things that we weren't expecting that came as a request from Santa Monica Studio that we had to kind of add in late in the game. And one of those was the next chapter. As we got closer to the launch of the game, Corey actually realized that he wanted to release or make available some kind of primer about Norse myth, just to kind of, you know, get fans a little bit fast forwarded to catch up on some of the history of Norse myth. So we went back, you know, to our offices and brainstormed a little bit. What could we do? And at this point, you know, the reality is that, you know, this stuff all cost money too. I mean, the agency has to get paid. Budgets are usually, you know, set up ahead of time. And so, you know, the closer you get to the end, the less money there is to do things. you just don't have, you know, an infinite, you know, supply of funds to pay. So not everything can be super elaborate. And that was, that's all part of the planning process of, hey, can we go from this big, you know, live action performance of Sandart? Let's maybe do something a little more conservative on the next chapter. And then we can, you know, kind of, use the assets and the funding we have wisely. So the challenge was to come up with some kind of primer that was economical, that could still be immersive and engaging and interesting, but, you know, wouldn't cost $1 billion to make. And so the second to the last chapter was the First Great War, and that was basically a story about the war of the gods, the two factions, the Aesir and the Vanir gods, warring against one another. And it's, you know, such a cool, interesting story. Yeah. So essentially what that was a giant illustration that we worked with Mood Visuals on. And it was
that's
really
the
kind
square
of
one, isn't it? The one that looks like a mural. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. And we were kind of inspired a little bit actually by Renaissance art. When you look up into the chapels and you see those really kind of beautiful, like multi-module, you know, kind of stories that are kind of told through art. We kind of drew a little bit of inspiration from that era, but then, you know, bringing it to life through that more kind of classical, you know, ancient Norse style of art. And it was a very intricate illustration. And the plan was to have these different sort of modules within it, or vignettes, I guess, that you can then zoom into and pan across, almost kind of like a Ken Burns, you know, documentary, where you get a lot of use out of these still images when you kind of pan across it, telling an interesting story. And that's what we did. We were lucky enough to be able to get the voice actor who played Mimir for a lot of these projects, and he kind of brought to life the story of the First Great War in this video. And then just prior to the game launch, you know, you always want to kind of lead up right to the point of where the game begins, and so the fans can now take over, pick up the controller, and start off right where you left off. Was when we released the final chapter, which was the augmented reality mobile application called Mimir's Vision. And we were thankful to get the blessing to actually reveal the first look at essentially the overworld map of Midgard.
The Lake of Nine. Yeah. We were blown away.
So we got access to some of the actual map data from within the game engine, and worked again with a group called, I believe it was the Mill that did that, to translate that data into something you could then put on your phone. And, you know, it's been a couple of years, so now augmented reality is like kind of, so ubiquitous, and it's everywhere, and it's just kind of in your in your pocket now. But, you know, a couple of years ago, it wasn't necessarily that way. So it was still pretty novel at the time to be able to take your phone out, point it at a flat surface, and see, you know, the Lake of Nine in Midgard kind of appear on your phone, and be able to zoom into it and, you know, tap on, you know, different, you know, landmarks in there, and get information about some of these really cool sections of the world that you're about to go have an adventure in, you know, within weeks. And that's how we kind of closed off the Lost Pages. We're so happy to see how amazingly well the game was received, with like hundreds of, you know, Game of the Year awards. You know, Corey, which I'm sure you've watched, you know, Corey's, you know, really moving video when the reviews started to come out, and seeing how moved he was by the positivity and the reception of the game was just, you know, what a great happy ending, you know, to that story.
And what I want now from here is for listeners maybe watching this back on the on sort of the later published versions, that you here, having expressed some of the and sort of uncovered some of the behind the scenes with this parallel, you know, there's the game development, there's the going goal, there's all of that on the game side, and then there's you there supporting it and acting as an interface between them and the community in many ways, which that's why, if maybe you've obviously probably made the connection, but with Topic Podcast Network and me, I have energetically wanted you to be my boss for years. Like, this is exactly my thing, and all of Topic Podcast Network generally, even with the God of War podcast, all of these ones, it's a giant interactive resume for how I believe is the way forward, which is tapping into that democratization, that you know, even surface that communities and creators are now occupying, and creating dialogues there and creating interactions there. It's like, it's the core of like my passion, that intersection between art and community. And what I would love for people to do, and I think they will once they see this one in their feed, is that they'll now have this context for your work. And as Corey was releasing his video, you know, the celebrations for you guys in your office of like, yeah, we did it, you know, we wrapped that up. And like to be able to be brought into that space of story sharing. I'm sure there's, I don't know if there's some things maybe you've revealed during this conversation, maybe that you hadn't before. Is there some of that, or is it stuff that you've already kind of covered in other ways, or was this the time to tell some of this stuff?
This was probably the most the longest somebody has willingly sat with me to talk about God
Don't
of War.
You even
you know in the past like couple of years, if I go in for something like a job interview, I like you know, I'll talk about a project like this, I'm like, you guys have to stop me from talking about this during this interview.
You have to keep, you have to come back.
I'll talk about this for 8 hours if you don't stop
me. Yes.
So having the opportunity to talk about this in a little bit more in depth with somebody who's clearly, you know, passionate and articulate and supportive of work like this is a treat for me. And I had a great time talking with you.
Yeah, man. And now I have to mention a few other things with your work. So I have done. I'm plugged into a couple of different spaces. You know, I know that Dune had some stuff with, I think, a site that went up, and some, you know, we won't even go into the NFT stuff. That I don't know any of that yet. It hasn't really fully integrated with me yet. But the Matrix did something where you could get. All I'm saying is, and this isn't just smoke blowing for your benefit, is like in terms of the level of each of the elements of this campaign, really knocking it out of the park. A phrase came to mind about 5 minutes ago of like all in, like you, Robert Sinclair, and your team went all in on this, as Sony went all in on this rebrand of God of War with that belief in Corey, you know, and that's an infectious thing when a director has that vision. And you hear that across all kinds of different art forms, like from film to games. And it's something where I'll just say this is for whatever kind of school or education kind of context that there is for, like, I want to be like Robert Sinclair. What can I do? Like, I think your work in terms of how this was, you know, handled, it stands as, just as God of War serves as a great template for, like, this is how you create a timeless game where art was prioritized, commerce came as a beautiful byproduct, and legacy and that evergreen quality came as a byproduct of artistic integrity. Your stuff, man, how you handle this campaign is like a textbook. Like, if there's ever a textbook for how to do this multifaceted campaign in support of a work of art, I mean, this is it. It's like from start to finish. So it has still been unmatched, and I don't think it'll be matched until your next version of this for whatever universe that you go on to do it for. And you have to let me know, because you have to let me have a conversation with you about it for sure.
I would love to do some kind of follow-up
please.
Whether it was, you know, for a game like this or mm-hmm. something else. I mean, it's something I'm pretty passionate about and would love to do.
Right.
It's, you know, as a creative, you know, working at an agency at kind of, you know, the employee level, you have very, very little to no choice about the kind of clients you get. So mm-hmm. as I said at the beginning, you might have to sell a jar of spaghetti sauce one day, or you might, you know, a car brand the next mm-hmm. day. So the advice I can give, you know, and it's, you've heard the saying before, which is, if you do what you love, you know, you'll never work a day in your life. So if you can find yourself in the position where you can actually be matched up with a topic that you're mm-hmm. passionate about, and you get paid for it, like,
I'm so glad to hear that it's kind of hard
to go wrong, and there's so many avenues now for people to do that. You know, the landscape of just work has changed so dramatically now. You know, it used to be, you know, that, you know, I have a daughter who's 7 years old, and it used to be when we were kids, and you ask what somebody wants to be when they grow up, I want to be the president, I want to be an astronaut, I want to be a firefighter, policeman. Now you ask kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? Yeah. They want to be you. They want to be a YouTuber.
Oh, cool.
That's the new measure of success. Why? Because it's obviously there, you know, there's these, you know, kind of edge cases where people have become insanely popular and mm-hmm. wealthy, you know, being a YouTuber. It's certainly the exception to the rules, kind of akin to kind of making it in Hollywood and, you know, all the thousands of people who try and just never get the big break that they've mm-hmm. been looking for. But it's such a democratizing platform that if you're passionate about something, there is mm-hmm. literally nothing stopping you from turning on your webcam, getting your friends together, talking about things that you love. And that, as you said, that passion can become infectious and things grow, and you never know, like, where it's going to go from there.
Perfectly expressed. The world and all barriers will yield to your passion and your truth, if it's this thing that is this unassailable thing for you. And now you have to tell your daughter, though, okay, I, honey, I talked to a YouTuber, but that YouTuber actually wants to work for me. So I just want to, because I do. And literally, like, I'm serious. We'll move. Ray is totally open to this. She loves traveling. If you need someone at your agency, like, that's like my, working with you is like my dream come true job. Like, seriously, dude. You know, I can balance everything.
It's a fun job. And, you know, I had a little bit of a not non-traditional path to kind of getting, mm-hmm. getting where I am. There's certainly, the valid path of going to art school. You know, my background, is as an art director. That's my kind of job discipline is art director. Mm-hmm. And I happen to, enjoy writing as well. Mm-hmm. But, typically you would go to, some kind of advertising or art academy, mm-hmm. and advertising school or college, and you kind of learn, the ropes, so to speak, yep. and hopefully get yourself an internship in an agency somewhere, and then, decide what mm-hmm. kind of path or department, most resonates with your interests and your skill and your talent, and move up kind of the ladder from there. For me personally, I skipped one of the big steps. Is I didn't go to school for this.
Okay.
And the fortunate position I had was being really interested as a kid in technology and mm-hmm. entertainment. Games. I've been playing games since the Atari 2600, and every mm-hmm. single console since then, PlayStation, Sega, yes. Nintendo, Xbox,
kid all spirit.
Of them, now, VR now. Mm-hmm. So, when I found myself at this intersection of being on a creative team where you get to use your imagination and your creativity to solve problems, and, thankfully found myself at, agencies I've worked in the past where they had video games as clients. I've been able to work on other franchises, like Call of Duty, mm-hmm. doing some fun stuff for, actually, you mentioned the name a couple of times, which always gets my hair to stand up, is Tolkien, and did some work for Shadow of Mordor game for Warner Brothers. That was super fun.
You have to jump on the Lord of the Rings. We just had Bridie Sison, who plays the Dweller in Rings of Power, the woman with the shaved head and the, all this kind of sorceress stuff. She was just on yesterday. And so now we're going to have to talk with you on the Lord of the Rings podcast about your work with the...
I mean, if I could talk for 8 hours about God of War, I could talk
you may.
20 hours about the Lord of the Rings is my favorite.
Okay.
I'm a huge movie fan, and Lord of the Rings is my favorite trilogy.
When I saw your work, Tolkien came up. I see that quote that you added, whatever. I think maybe now we've made a connection because of that. And it's look, honestly, it's been one of the most enlightening and illuminating and additive conversations. I think going into revisiting, as I will be definitely over the years to come, the work that you've done, it will be permanently enhanced by this conversation. Here's to many more conversation. On podcasting tape, are you ready to say that you'll come back for something? If I just only if you have the time, if it's not too much trouble for you.
Yeah. I'd be happy. I mean, this is, something I love talking about, and again, it's a rare chance for me to have a captive audience of somebody who's willing to talk to me about this.
Not rare anymore.
Yeah, for sure. And if anybody has any questions or wants to hear more about particular things, there's certainly, the opportunity to kind of deep dive into some of these chapters and, talk a little bit more about each one. Yeah, for sure. Now, when we were talking earlier about the podcast and those episodes, those stories, so many people aren't aware of those, right? That they don't know that they exist. One of the things that I've always wanted to do and just never had the opportunity. And if anybody's out there, one of the things I've always wanted to do with those stories from each episode of the podcast was to create a printed, not a real printed, but sort of like a PDF version that you could read instead of just listen to. A lot of people, you know, a lot of people are just not into podcasts, or they just never, you know, heard it. And I've always wanted to find, I've always wanted to find like an artist in the community who would be willing to like do some illustrations for the story. And if and if anybody out there, you know, would be willing to kind of collaborate and do some like concept art, for stories like that, I still have like all of the text versions of those stories. I would love to like lay those out and just kind of release those as a, you know, I don't know if I'm, you know, technically, you know, allowed to do that, but
Speaking as a creator, like you'd love that tactile book in your hand of like the lot, you know, the work that you've done. And look, I think that everyone would be on board for that. So I guess put out feelers, because that would be incredible. And when people listen back to this, get back to me. I think maybe the live, when I shared out the link, who knows how the algorithm works, you and I could have a whole podcast about the algorithm and what it's done sometimes to like live recordings of things. But they'll definitely see this on the back watch. And they, I'll definitely probably get some, definitely going to get some inquiries from people about that. But it's, I think it's an unquestioned thing that if the actual SSM, like SMS, like they wanted to put something like that together. And I, but my thing as your podcast lawyer, I would have to insist that your name, Robert Sinclair, be either on the front cover somewhere, or it's like, or just very, like very prominent somewhere, because it was this thing that you pulled together and that you had a big hand in writing. And wouldn't that be great? Yeah, you're right. Like to have everyone credited of like, they wrote this, they wrote that, you know? Yeah.
I would sneak all of our names, all of the copywriters' names in, and the Elder Futhark runes. I'd just
In there. All right. Well, for me, that's not just an idea. That's, we're going to put that in motion. I'll do whatever I can in this sphere of like, just putting words in people's ears for that. But dude, it has been such a pleasure, and look, the generosity of your time, an hour and a half over that, even, we seriously appreciate it. I know it's a bit late for you there. What's on for the rest of the night? Probably just like dinner in bed, or that's it?
I've already watch a movie. Got the screen set up behind me. It's what I do most nights, is I love movies and stories, and usually we'll try to watch a few movies every week, and we'll
see what's, if you haven't seen The Green Knight yet, The Green Knight, mate. A24 is The Green Knight. Oh, it's a good one. Yeah, definitely. That's one where, look, now is the part where I manifest all the things for you. I think, unless it's already happened.
Are you talking about the A24? One, the
A24. I was just about to say, like, they did.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that Green Knight.
Oh, yeah, that's the one. Yeah. And I wanted to say this about, like, your work being something that they, A24, I'll just put this out. I'm just going to put all these things out so they'll snowball into eventual things for you. So A24, they absolutely, I mean, they're fools if they haven't contacted you yet, but they would definitely benefit from a Robert Sinclair kind of crossover thing where you help them with some amazing upcoming film for sure. And Star Wars, I'm going to manifest that for you. Definitely. We got a lot of Dune stuff coming. Have you done any Star Wars stuff yet?
I was a Star Wars kid, right? I grew up watching those movies. I watched the trilogy dozens of times in the theater. Yeah. I had all the toys. I had the Star Wars bed sheets, the wallpaper, the whole nine yards.
All right.
And it's only because of the, you know, some of the missteps of the prequels that Lord of the Rings was able to come in and sort of supplant Star Wars as my passion. But you know, between sci-fi and fantasy, you know, I'll give them kind of equal billing. But yeah, Star Wars is another favorite of mine, and watching, you know, series, you know, especially on Disney Plus now with Andor. And,
good.
It feels like kind of a new golden age for that.
A new golden age. You've just given the listeners a really awesome teaser of like, that's among the stuff that I'll be just very gently, whenever Robert's having a bit of a slow weekend or something, I'll just be like, hey, let's talk about Andor. Let's talk about Fallen Order's sequel, Jedi Survivor. They have to contact you for something leading up to that one. So I'll put that out for you into the universe for sure, mate.
Appreciate the good thoughts and the goodwill. And thanks again for inviting me in. It was a great time talking to you.
Definitely, mate. Well, to everyone tuning into this. Now, Robert, you are not yet on Instagram, and I don't know if we can beckon you here, but you would be heartily welcomed. Seriously, I'll tag you, back tag you into all the ones I've shared. If you don't do the social media thing, that's fine. But definitely robertsinclair.com. That's actually in the description. Anywhere else people can find you?
That's probably the best place. I'm moderately active on social media. I slow down. You know, once you have a kid, like your yeah. dynamic of being on social media changes because it's less, you okay. know, it's more about like here's all the things my kid did today. Uh-huh. So I admit I'm not quite as active on Instagram as I should be. But yeah, if people want to see any more of my work or contact me, robertsinclair.com. And that is my website. Yeah. You can see my portfolio there and get into contact with me if you have any questions or comments or just want to chat. I'm always happy to.
And to join the, and you don't have to comment on this, that's fine, to join the bring Robert Sinclair back for the next God of War and the next one, set in the Aztec times or whatever. Total speculation. Mate, it has been such a pleasure. Have an amazing, amazing rest of your night, and feel like I met a kindred spirit and made a friend today. Hell yeah. Yeah,
feel the same. Thanks so much.
See you, mate. Be well. Bye. All right. Bye-bye. Take it easy, man.